Welcome, writers, to our new episode on the art and craft of writing fiction. This is Jim Thayer. I received a message from our listener, Marie, and it touched at the heart of what we writers do. She wrote, "The page count goal for my novel is 300 pages. However, I'm finding it difficult to write enough content to fill 300 pages with my story. I'm avoiding writing things that aren't building the story and creating tension since I don't want the book to be boring, but I'm having a hard time writing pages leading up to the main point of the book." That's Marie. Marie's comment is a good one, and it points to the main job of a writer, inventing stuff. If we are having trouble filling out our story, what can we do? The answer is both hard and simple. We need to put on the thinking cap and fill out our story with characters and events. Easy to say, harder to do, I know. But this creativity is a main part of a writer's job, and to be a writer, we just do it. We invent stuff. But what? One of my favorite quotes about writing is from Kurt Vonnegut about plotting. This is Kurt Vonnegut. "Somebody gets into trouble and then gets out again. Somebody loses something and gets it back. Somebody is wronged and gets revenge. Cinderella. Somebody hits the skids and just goes down, down, down. People fall in love with each other, and a lot of other people get in the way. A virtuous person is falsely accused of sin. A sinful person is believed to be virtuous. A person faces a challenge bravely and succeeds or fails. A person lies. A person steals. A person kills. I guarantee you that no modern story scheme will give a reader genuine satisfaction unless one of those old-fashioned plots is smuggled in somewhere." That's Kurt Vonnegut. He is advising us to invent stuff. A good way to do this is put another obstacle or two between your hero and his or her goal. What is keeping our hero from her goal? A fire, an illness, dozens of other things. And related to that, we can add a new character. A nasty father-in-law, a swindler, a conceited, self-centered person, a character who chronically makes bad choices. I don't know Marie's plot, but I suspect she simply doesn't have enough plot because she hasn't sat in front of her laptop and thought about it. Our job as writers is to come up with plot, then more plot. If Marie and if you and I turn to this, we'll come up with great plot angles that'll work well in our story. It's a matter of doing the work. I know my advice is nothing more than get to work, but it's the only answer I know to Marie's problem. I want to mention another thing related to that. For most of us, coming up with plot is a matter of work. It's a matter of sitting down and thinking about it in front of our screen or with a pen in hand. To get results, we have to focus, to pay attention to the task at hand. It isn't a matter of relaxing or daydreaming or playing video games or chatting with a loved one or watching TV or playing golf. For most of us, these fun activities, often the best parts of our lives, don't result in new plot. Roger Ebert, the movie critic, notes, and this is one of the most important sentences I've ever found regarding writing. This is Roger Ebert: "The muse visits during composition, not before." And the great sci-fi writer Orson Scott Card agrees. He says, "Don't wait for a muse to strike and force you to your typewriter. Such events are rare. In my experience, muses tend to strike those who are at the keyboard typing their brains out, not those who are playing video games in the basement." That's my comments to Marie. It's as harsh as get to work, but I sometimes can use hearing it, and maybe you do too. Please allow me a moment of self-promotion. My new novel, Fagin and Miss Havisham, is now available at Amazon. The publisher is Creative Texts, an independent publisher, and a good one. My novel is the story of famous Charles Dickens characters taking place when they were younger than in his novels. Fagin and Miss Havisham is a prelude to the world of Charles Dickens. So we meet the pickpocket Fagin and the thumper Bill Sykes from Oliver Twist when they were younger, and the crazy Miss Havisham and the unstoppable lawyer Jaggers when they were younger, and Police Inspector Bucket from Bleak House, and the evil Murdstone from David Copperfield, and many others. I love Charles Dickens' novels, and have since I was young, and in Fagin and Miss Havisham, I mix them all together earlier in their lives to see what happens. Please consider getting a copy of my new novel. You'll see the techniques we talk about in these episodes in action, at least the best I can do them. And it'd be much appreciated. We writers know about showing as opposed to telling. Let me summarize in a couple of sentences. Showing reveals, while telling explains. Showing is almost always more engaging for the reader because showing presents evidence to the reader about a character or setting or situation and allows the reader to make his or her own conclusions, as opposed to telling, where the writer essentially gives a lecture to the reader. You've heard me mention before that my favorite sentences to keep the difference between showing and telling clear in my mind are these. He scratched his arm. This is showing that his arm itches. It is evidence given to the reader, as opposed to his arm itched. This is telling that his arm itched. It's a little lecture. Knowing the difference between showing and telling is a critical skill for us writers. Showing enlivens the page. Telling dulls the page. Let's combine two things, showing and dialogue. Dialogue in a story is fun to write for the author and it's fun to read for the reader. Ever notice this? When you're in a bookstore and you pick up a novel to consider it, and you flip through the pages, your eye will most often fall on dialogue on the page. Readers like dialogue, and so we writers should give them a lot of it. Dialogue is a strong way to show things about our characters, and that's because our character reveals herself through her own words. Instead of "Maddie was angry," which is telling, we show anger with her dialogue. "Get away from me, Joe. Leave me alone." This dialogue is evidence that she's angry. Instead of telling Lisa was tired, we can let her reveal herself with her dialogue. "I'm beat," Lisa said. "I'm going to sleep for a day and a half." "John was flustered," is telling. Here is John showing with his own dialogue. John said, "I don't get it. The pieces don't fit, and the diagram isn't any help." "Abby was in awe of her friend Jenny," is telling. How about this, to show Abby's awe with her own dialogue? "How did you do it, Jenny?" Abby asked. "I'm amazed. You're the first ever to swim it in under 52 seconds. "Jillian was cranky," is textbook telling. It's the writer's little lecture about Jillian's mood. How about this instead, presenting evidence with Jillian's dialogue? "Don't bother me, please. I don't know where the saxophone is, and I can't find it, and I'm going to give up looking." Isn't that so much better than "Jillian was cranky"? "Greg was saddened by his friend leaving," is telling. "I'm going to miss him," Greg said. "Hope we can get together again sometime." That's showing. Here's telling. "Amanda was delighted." Being delighted is wonderful in real life and in fiction too, but "Amanda was delighted" is a dull sentence. Here is showing. Amanda laughed. Where did you get that puppy? He's so cute. You named her Jazzy? That's so sweet. Can I hold her? Isn't that so much better than Amanda was delighted? Adrian was disgusted. Well, that's classic telling. Here's showing. Keep that thing away from me. What is it? It's gross, and it smells, too. Don't get near me with that. That's fun to write, and it's so much better to write and read than Adrian was disgusted. Ben was amused, is telling, and a duller sentence has never been typed. Ben laughed, then said, hit him right in the face with a pillow. Holy cow. That's showing he's amused. Jean felt guilty. That is a ponderous and dull bit of telling. It's awful. Try this. I'm sorry, Jean said. I shouldn't have said that, and I shouldn't have done it. I hope you can forgive me. Boy, that's a strong plot point. Put right out there, Jean giving evidence that she feels guilty. Here's another telling. Maria was satisfied. Try this instead, showing. Good, Maria said, dusting her hands together. I'm done, and it only took me an hour. Here's telling. Toby was ashamed and embarrassed. Here's how to show it. I should never have done that. What was I thinking? I won't be able to show my face there ever again. That's Toby revealing to the reader, in his own words, that he's ashamed and embarrassed. Here's another one, our last one. Mark was relieved. Well, that's dull telling. How about this for showing? Mark threw the rope around the horse's neck. Boy, that was close. You almost made it to the gate in the highway. Don't do that again, okay, Trigger? That's so much better. See how easy this is, and it's such a good technique. Instead of dull telling about our character's emotions, we let the character present evidence to the reader with our character's own words. The difference between telling Mark was relieved and showing, boy, that was close. His dialogue is huge. And knowing the difference is a critical skill for us writers. We can tell about our character's emotions, or we can give evidence, that is, showing, with their own words. I was sent a message with the question, what should I do if my first draft exceeds the commercially accepted word count for my genre? The answer is simple and quick. Do what you can to cut the story back toward the usual genre word count. That's hard to do. And the easier thing to do is, before we begin writing, determine the word count range that a publisher wants for our genre. Jane Friedman, who for many years was at Random House and then was the CEO of HarperCollins, has said a target of about 80,000 words is good for most novels in most genres. She said that below 50,000 is the threshold for a novel, and that above 120,000 is usually too many words. Writer's Digest has said that 80 to 90,000 words is a safe range for most all genres. It's easy to do an internet search to find word count guidelines for our genres. And it's important that we believe these word count guidelines and aim to have our novels with these word counts. Readers expect certain lengths, and so publishers expect certain lengths. It's likely that if you send an agent or publisher a 150,000-word novel, it'll be rejected without the agent or editor even bothering to look at it. And this is important. We shouldn't put ourselves in a position where we have to cut our novel once we learn the standard word length of our genre. Cutting out paragraphs and pages and chapters that we sweated over is hard. Maybe if we do so, our novel won't even make sense. So our technique is this. It's a lesson. Learn our word count goal before we start writing. A little research online will give us a good idea of the acceptable word count range for the genre we're writing in. We can type into Google, novel genre word count, and lots of information will be produced. Or go to a bookstore, pick up a bestseller in your genre, count the words in a line, a couple of lines so you get an average, then multiply that number by the lines on the page, then multiply that by the number of pages in a book. It sounds old school, but I've done just that. We can do this math with a couple bestsellers and as we stand in the bookstore using our cell phone's math app, and then aim for that number in our own novel. It'll save us a lot of work writing the extra pages and a lot of work having to then cut them out once we learn the word count. And it will also save us from automatic rejections from agents and editors that will occur if we send a manuscript far too long or far too short. Figure out the word count range in advance and then aim for that number. This is a solid technique. How did William Styron work? Styron was the author of Sophie's Choice, The Confessions of Nat Turner, and other novels. He passed away in 2006. Mason Curry sets out how Styron worked in Curry's terrific book, Daily Rituals. Styron famously said, "Let's face it, writing is hell." This is Mason Curry. To minimize the pain, Styron evolved an unusual daily routine. He would sleep until noon, then read and think in bed for another hour or so before lunch with his wife at 1:30. In the early afternoon, he ran errands and dealt with the mail, then began the slow process of easing into work mode. Mason Curry continues regarding William Styron. "Listening to music was a key part of this transition." Styron said, "I often have to play music for an hour in order to feel exalted enough to face the act of composing." That's Styron. By 4 o'clock, he was ready to move to his study for his daily 4 hours, which would typically yield only about 200 or 300 words. At 8 o'clock, he would join his family and friends for cocktails and dinner, after which he would drink, smoke, read, and listen to music until 2 or 3 in the morning. Styron never drank while writing, but he thought that alcohol was a valuable tool for relaxing the mind and inviting, quote, certain visionary moments, end quote, when thinking about the work. Mason Curry goes on, "An interviewer once asked Styron if he found that his comfortable upper-middle-class lifestyle. He lived with his wife and their 4 children in a pair of large houses in Connecticut and on Martha's Vineyard. Had been helpful to his writing, or if it had been confining in some ways. I think it's been a stabilizing and important influence," Styron replied. "I could not have lived in Bohemia or lived the life of a renegade or pariah. I have had in my little study in Connecticut all these years that famous line from Flaubert tacked to my wall, quote, be regular and orderly in our life, like a bourgeoisie, so that we may be violent and original in our work. I believe it." That's William Styron, and that's Mason Curry on how Styron worked. I would like to talk about using strong verbs rather than a weak verb and an adverb. I've mentioned this technique in an earlier episode, and I want to return to it today because it's so important. It's a key to strong writing, and it's this. Use a strong verb rather than a weak verb modified by an adverb. We want our writing to be powerful, and a principal way to do this is to use power verbs. Here are some examples of weak verbs modified with an adverb, I think because the writer thought of the weak word and then wanted to ramp it up, as opposed to a strong word, a strong verb. Here's an example. He spoke softly. The verb, of course, is spoke, and then the adverb is softly. The writer should have used he whispered. How about this? He hit me on the arm lightly. Well, the writer is thinking, hit me on the arm. Now, that's too powerful. That doesn't say what I mean, so I'm going to make it less than a hit. I'll add the word lightly. He hit me on the arm lightly. That's a weak sentence. How about he tapped my arm? She laughed heartily. Well, the writer didn't think laughing was enough, so after thinking about it, I presume, added the modifier heartily. Instead of, she could have used a stronger verb, she guffawed or she chortled. Here's a weak verb modified with an adverb. She walked smoothly over the lawn. Smoothly is the adverb. How about she glided over the lawn? The adverbs quickly and slowly are often telltales regarding verbs that could be stronger. He ran quickly, as opposed to he sprinted or he dashed. The horse ran quickly. The writer doesn't think ran is fast enough, so adds quickly. Instead of the writer should have used the horse galloped. She dressed quickly. A better phrase is she threw on her clothes. She quickly stirred the soup. Well, if you're writing about stirring the soup, probably writing a dull scene, but she churned the soup is better. He quickly ate his food. See, the writer has typed he ate his food, but and then thought, you know, that isn't percussive and fast enough. So the writer adds quickly. He quickly ate his food, adds the modifier, quickly. He should have written, he gulped his food. The writer writes, he talked quickly. Should have written, she chattered, or she babbled, or she exclaimed. She quickly entered the water. That's a weak sentence. How about she plunged into the water? And that's a nice image. The key here, and it's a solid technique, is when we are thinking of using an adverb to modify a verb, we should stop and think a minute. Maybe we can come up with a stronger verb that doesn't need a modifier. She walked quickly out onto the floor can be changed to she rushed out onto the floor. It's stronger writing. It's better writing. Regrettably, none of our listeners has asked for my list of favorite words. Favorite words, you ask? Jim, you have favorite words, like you had a favorite color back in kindergarten? Don't you have something better to think about? To which I reply, yes, I have favorite words, and no, I don't have anything better to think about, which is a shame, really. I made a list the other day while I was reading words that popped off the page. These words are all negative summaries, as that's what caught my attention at the time. They are accusatory and carry a lot of freight. I like to think I'm a sunny person, charitable in my opinions, but I still like these words. Here they are, some of my favorite words. Poltroon. What a great word. And it means characterized by abject cowardice. Here's another one. Knucklehead, which is, of course, a stupid person. My parents must have used that word, probably my dad, because I'm aware of it since I was 3 years old, I think. Here's a good word, gormless, G-O-R-M-L-E-S-S, which means lacking sense or someone who's foolish. Spineless. How about the word rakehell? And that's a dissolute man who is in fashionable society. He was a rakehell. What a great word. Another good word, scoundrel. How about reprobate, which is an unprincipled person? Here's a good one we all know, dolt. Here's another one, numbskull. That's another word that seems to come from my childhood. Blockhead. Remember that in the comic strip Peanuts? Blockhead was Lucy's favorite invective. Here's a good strong word, oaf. She's an oaf. Or here's another one, ninny. Ninny, N-I-N-N-Y. These words are all telling rather than showing, but still, they're unusual, and they're forceful words that carry a potent meaning. We should use forceful words when we can, not dime a dozen pablum words. These words will fit the bill. If I come up with a list of my favorite sunny words, I'll let you know. I hope and trust you don't have any rakehells or reprobates or blockheads in your life. I don't mind, and that's a good place to be. Until next time, this is Jim Thayer. Please keep tapping those keys.